One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford lecturer, a writer and a broadcaster, and for the purposes of this podcast, I'm your chief investigator of images. Today is a particularly exciting podcast for me because I'm joined by, well, I suppose I could describe you as my pub buddy. Mark Canham, the composer, is, I'm fortunate enough to call, a very dear friend and drinking buddy, and is going to bring a really unique insight today because we're talking particularly about music and particularly about Kandinsky. But tell the Art Detective listeners what you do, Mark.
Well, I'm a composer and I write music for film, mainly, and then self-released albums, and also I've just begun working with a fine artist doing interesting augmented reality pieces with the art, with putting music into paintings, which is a very interesting spin on what I do. So in essence, I'm a composer. I'm inspired by images, and I write music to those images, and that can come in many forms, but at the moment, film and art.
And actually, the one you did, the collaboration that you did recently, it was for the, it was a World War One, it was a poppy theme, wasn't it?
It was to commemorate the Somme.
Yeah.
So that launched last year in London. And since then, the gallery has been touring around the country. It's called The Danger Tree by the artist Scarlett Raven. And the process is that she almost works in a kind of stop motion fashion where she will have a camera poised above her canvas, and she paints in oils mainly, but with blue screen technology as well, or a kind of blue screen paint. Mm. And so for every movement of paint that she does, and she paints with her hands and with objects more than she paints with brushes, she'll take a picture and she'll collage that with images from the First World War. And that will build up and up and up and up. And once we've reached about 3,500, 4,000 images, we've kind of got enough to put together the movies that when you go into the gallery and see the painting in front of you, the finished painting, there's actually been dozens of iterations of that painting before. And so you can kind of see the story behind the painting.
Can't you hold up your phone or your iPad and you see the creation to your music of that image that's in front of you?
Totally. I mean, I can give you some images for your listeners.
We'll do that. I'll put a link to it because I watched it and I was moved to tears. I thought it was absolutely beautiful, Mark. And I'm not just saying that because we're friends. No. It was amazing. And the relationship between music and art was so clear there. And it obviously has informed a lot of what you do when you compose the visual.
It adds a whole dimension to it, I think. And as you say, it is extremely powerful. It's not an uplifting experience. They're quite traumatic, some of them. But yeah, by using this technology that you can get on your iPads or phones called Blipper, you hold your device up to the paintings, and the painting comes to life in the real world to you. So actually, we're playing with new ideas because the gallery is expanding, and because it's the 100 years anniversary next year. There's some really, really amazing things planned with taking this whole concept on massively, whereby the real world interacts even more with the augmented world, and it's just a really powerful storytelling device, I find. And music is key.
Like with all these things, where there's a creative process, sometimes you don't just want to see the finished piece. You want to see the creative process that's gone into it. And I love this idea. I mean, the thing is, it's so beautiful at all the different stages. That's why I love it so much, because you could stop it at any point and go, there, it's done, it's perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love that idea of the idea that the artist has reached a finished point in their mind.
Yeah.
And then you can create the composition that also reaches a form of conclusion. But you work on film as well, don't you? And that must be a different exercise, because do you get sent the finished film and then you compose to it?
Yeah. Once the film is pretty much finished, and you cross your fingers and toes that they're not going to do any re-edits or anything like that, because it can be a bit difficult to if a little bit of scene is cut out, sort of two-thirds from the end. Everything has to shuffle around.
No. And where's my dramatic climax?
It is like someone hiding a piece of jigsaw puzzle for you for ages. And it's quite annoying. But so the process in film, they send you what they call reels, which can be sort of two reels, three reels that make up the content of the film.
Are they big metal things that you have to put on the project?
Well, that's exactly why they call them reels, because in the old days, they used to be reels.
I still have visions of someone turning up at your door with big circular reels of film.
I love the analog world. I like to talk in terms of the old school. And so we get sent these reels and we chat with the director and we start pulling ideas together and talking about what the scenes need. And I like to work with directors that aren't too prescriptive and try and tell the audience what to feel too much. I like to help, embellish what's there on the screen rather than be overly diagnostic with what's on the screen. And often we talk about colour when we're discussing.
This brings us round, because I mean, you're involved in some really exciting. What was the big film that you did?
The Disappearance of Alice Creed with Eddie Marsan and Gemma Arterton.
Yeah.
Directed by Jay Blakeson, was a real favourite of mine. I'm really, really proud of the work that was done on that one.
Well, so. I'm very proud of you too.
Thank you.
Doing some amazing things at the moment. He's been showing me some secret things that he's working on at the moment. We can't talk about, but they're super exciting. We are looking at an image in your studio, which I have to say is the coolest studio ever. One of the things I love about the way you write music, Mark, is it's all analog, isn't it? I mean, you use organic, you use instruments. You don't do it all digitally. Even if you use bits and bobs, they're all rooted in original instruments, aren't they?
I think from having composed now for a long time, one of the things that being a composer does, and when I speak to other composers in those rare occasions, I escape the studio and speak to human beings, you actually become less of a good musician on that on your instrument. Uh-huh. So I come from being a guitarist. But
lost member of Radiohead.
The lost member of Radiohead. and so as a result, I'm fascinated with sound and texture. Yeah. And I think that's half of the reason why we're going to chat about Kandinsky specifically.
There you go, he's giving you a heads up, aren't you?
sorry.
I'm giving you a big build up, Mark.
and by playing with sound and recording sound in odd ways and manipulating it through all the ways we can manipulate it nowadays with the really cool tools that we have available to us, you can create never before heard sounds.
Oh,
yeah. Whereas I love playing with violins and with cellos and playing with and giving great musicians the music to play for that. But there's a real fascination of mine is to sort of, how do I get that violin sound to sound a little bit more metal?
You can create
a heck of a lot of emotion with texture. And we are somewhat trained in film, especially, to lean a lot on melody as to tell us what to feel. And I'm a believer that I think texture can be doubly as effective as that sometimes, you know.
Well, this brings us on to the reason why I have selected you among these honoured few to be my guest today, because we are looking at Kandinsky, Yellow, Red, Blue, 1925. Now, Vasily Kandinsky, possibly one of my favourite artists ever, not just because of his art, it being so, well, really the birth of abstraction, really, but also this particular image hung on my bed when I was at university. So I've stared at it for many, many years. And the reason I've asked you to come and talk about it is for this amazing reason that we discovered when talking after some wine.
Yes.
You have synesthesia.
I have synesthesia, yeah.
So explain to the listeners what that means.
So this is where you can hear sound. Oh, well, for me, synesthesia comes in different forms, and there's a neurological form of it, which has some, it's quite disturbing when you hear the effects of how that is on people. But I have a form of synesthesia where I hear a sound, and for me it's most vibrant with piano, specifically. It's when I first really noticed it, where it can generate colours. So I think over the years, and I think it actually leads into why I like texture as well as a tool, that over the years I've kind of had it in my back pocket as a secret weapon. Whenever I've been stuck on a scene, okay, well, what is the scene? You know, especially if you see a finished scene that's beautifully graded, and I can think of a few examples when working on film where that's happened, where I can write in green.
Oh my goodness!
Or I can write in sort of orangey brown.
Well, you shouted at me the other day at the car, didn't you? It's an orange brown piece of music. Oh my god! Yeah, your mind fascinates me.
But you get kind of used to dealing with it and working with it, and it's a real privilege to have it as a thing to use, and it's very emotively connected as well, so that you won't, if I'm not in the mood, it's nowhere near as vibrant or obvious to draw upon. But whereas when you are tuned into it and it's happening, it kind of writes, the music kind of writes itself.
I mean, we've got so much to explore with this for the listeners, but the reason that we've chosen Kandinsky in particular is he is probably the artist most closely associated with synesthesia. He writes a lot. The other reason I love him is because not only is he an amazing artist, but he's also an art theorist. And he writes some incredible texts exploring the emergence of non-narrative art, but also the power of colour. And he has really, really clear delineations on what each colour, each shape in his works actually means.
That's true.
He feels moods. But you said this too. So I remember you telling me how you discovered you had it. Wasn't it a music lesson or something?
I was actually, I was in my teens. And
I remember it could be very much a sexual awakening story, to be honest.
Yeah. That's the smile I had on my face. It was, and a friend was giving me Reiki, which isn't...
That's right, that's why I brought this element
and she wasn't a professed Reiki expert, but she had been learning about it, and it just so happened to be an amazing pianist, like proper concert pianist, and unfortunately she had a really bad RSI, and so it actually halted her career, sadly. But I came around the house and she said, oh, I've been studying Reiki, you know, do you fancy it? And I'm like, well, what's that then?
Oh my god.
And
this is not the sort of experience I had when I was a teenager. Yeah, it still sounds very bohemian.
So I was lying down in her in her living room, which had a baby grand piano in it. And she as I was having Reiki, she hit a couple of notes on the piano, and I said, oh, that's funny, that's really purple. Wow. And she went, what about this? And we went through notes, and it does change, actually. It's not always the same notes. But she said, I think you've got synesthesia.
Oh my gosh.
And I didn't know what that was at the time.
How old were you again?
I must have been 16 or 17. Right. when I observed it acutely.
But you'd see, presumably, like, this had been in your life. You were aware it was happening.
Yeah. I think you realise that you're, something's happening emotionally. You're connecting at some point before that.
Yeah.
And there were moments where music would be very vivid and you couldn't quite put your finger on it.
I'm sure we all feel that in a way.
I think it's actually quite common.
Because actually, I mean, I see it with my kids, that they will cry at certain chords and, you know, changes. I've always felt that too. You get that emotional moment where you just, something happens, but never in colour. And so did you never think
I'm sure you would have had it. I think
you don't see it like puffs of colour coming out of the notes or anything. You just see it in your interior mind.
When I think back to that moment, when she played the piano, it almost was a puff of colour.
That's what fascinates me.
It almost was, and when you're that tuned into it, I think being in that state of mind anyway, I was very relaxed. I think being in that state of mind helped the process, because I was emotionally in the right space to observe it. And I think when you watch powerful visuals, you can get yourself into that emotional state as well and tap into
I mean absolutely, I think you're totally right. So it was almost inevitable in a way that you were going to end up writing in the way that you do, you know, visuals and sound together, composing.
And how I sound. I think my music is quite textural.
Absolutely.
You know, as part of a jobbing composer, you have to use certain instruments because you're asked to by a director or a producer, you know, to try out things, and those things can stick. But I think underlying all my music that I do, there is an element of this happening.
Yeah. And okay, so you suggested Kandinsky when we talked about what we were going to look at. In terms of, I mean, when I first encountered the idea of synesthesia, it was Kandinsky that I looked at immediately, because I feel he's so clear about what he's doing, but he's also trying to work it out with a vocabulary that is academic, that is scientific, that makes sense. So he talks a lot about shapes, and this one we're particularly looking at, yellow, red, blue. So it's massive for a start. It's 2 meters.
It's 2 meters wide, isn't it?
2 meters wide, 120-ish high. It's huge.
Is this one that's over in New York?
I believe so.
Yeah.
But also, in terms of how this makes you feel, walk me through it. Walk me through the colours, because, I mean, I can tell you what Kandinsky says afterwards, but in terms of what you see and feel, what does this make you feel?
I find it very dreamy, and I find it's almost like two paintings in one, this one, because on the left-hand side, you have what I think you instinctively interpret as a face looking to the left of the picture.
Do you know, my whole time when I had this on my wall, I see an upside-down cat.
Do you?
Can you not see it? The whiskers, the two eyes. Oh, come on, we've both got cats. Can't you see it? There's whiskers coming out on that side, two orangey eyes and a nose. Anyway,
that's
what I've always seen. But you're right, I think there's definitely, the composition has some suggestion of a face.
A very abstract face, or cat.
Cat or human.
to the left-hand side of it. And then I've always sort of seen the right-hand side of it, which is where he overlaps a lot more colours and geometric shapes and squiggles, which he's obviously really well known for, and the grid pattern, which is a recurring theme in a lot of his paintings, as almost like the subconscious, the thought process going on behind the human being.
And about the colours? What do they make you feel then?
Well, he loved yellow.
Yes. Yellow's the key, isn't it?
He loved yellow. And I think for a period of time, him and we'll probably talk about this a little bit later, him and Schoenberg talked a lot about sort of rule books of colour and sound.
Yeah.
And he used trumpets a lot.
Exactly.
For yellow.
Yes.
And yellow is obviously a colour that we find as a happy colour and a chirpy colour. Whereas blue is one of the more thoughtful colours in his interpretation. And then brown is, like, because he uses ochre a lot, and browns, they're the ones that kind of root us a little bit more with the earthliness, you know, what's happening on Earth.
Do you feel that too when you compose? Do you think his parallels are equivalent?
Yeah, I think where he talks about yellow, I probably have orange in that spectrum a little bit.
Yeah.
I think there's a very close similarity. And purple's just this mysterious colour which kind of transcends things.
Really? Yeah. Purple's the one?
Yeah,
purple. Isn't that amazing? Because he talks about purple, because you've obviously got that lovely suede of purple. And I mean, what is so fascinating about this is the meeting of those three primary colours, the red, the blue, the yellow. And you know, you've talked about this being a painting of two halves. I think you're absolutely right, because on the one half you've got a yellow composition, on the other it's more blue. But there's this meeting of colours that creates these syntheses of feelings. Mm. So the red is sort of more impassioned. These are all things we instinctively, intuitively know, but we don't understand necessarily the colour theory behind them. And then the blue is the cool and the calm and the spectral, the sort of the distant. He talks about things receding and coming forward. So yellow comes out at you as a colour, whereas blue pulls away from you, and sort of it's colder, it's pulling away. Do you feel that too?
Well, yeah, because blue is kind of like the sky and the atmosphere and the distance, and so it has this kind of more distant feel to it. It's one of those colours, and blue is a tricky colour to write in.
Really?
Yeah. Blue is a hard one.
So it's not blue melancholia blue.
No. I don't know. I definitely don't have blue down as a melancholic thing. It's a thoughtful colour.
Because I suppose it's sort of celestial, transcendental, otherworldly, out of body.
The music of the spheres, you know, the when the philosophers are trying to look up into the stars and try and justify what's going on and why are these patterns recurring, you know, every day, every week, every month, every year.
I can imagine that is incredibly hard to write for, actually, because it's outside the body, it's outside the human experience. And I suppose that's what he's talking about, things coming forward and things receding.
Mm.
He talks about shapes doing that as well. Circles are the perfect shape for him because there's this sense of, humanity surrounded and enclosed and safe.
They're quite tidy shapes, aren't they, circles? They make sense.
They do. And the squiggle is sort of breaking that circle. It's sort of, and then, of course, you've got black and white, which is prevalent throughout this. I think what's really interesting is the amount of white paint on the left-hand side recedes and the amount of black paint coming up increases. And he talks about painting in the same words as we talk about music, because he creates the compositions.
Yeah.
He talks about crescendos. He talks about, you know, these ideas of improvisation as well.
But he names his pictures depending on how developed they are.
The
compositions were the more complicated ones, weren't they?
Yeah.
And then the sort of sketchier kind of ideas were the improvisations, weren't they?
And his compositions were sort of finished pieces. And actually, there was a set of them that were at the Bauhaus, and I believe that most of them have been lost. He is an interesting person in himself. We haven't really given much background for Kandinsky, but he lived across that really extraordinary time of two world wars, you know? I mean, I love him, again, and the third level of why I love him. I love him as an artist, love him as an art theorist. I also love his spiritual quality, because one of the things he talks about, and he gets in a lot of trouble for doing in the climax to sort of World War One, is writing about apocalypse and resurrection. So he does quite a lot of works that deal with, not necessarily Christian resurrection, but this idea of death and rebirth. And he is a Christian, but he's always touching on these ideas of cycles of life. And he believed that the time he was living through was an end of days in the build-up to World War One. And in a way, you can kind of see him as a bit of a visionary, because what he wrote about in his works was this birth of a new age. Out of this will come something new, something different, something potentially better. And he's also constructs this amazing theory about the artist as the tip of the pyramid or the tip of the triangle, who's constantly trying to express what is coming before the rest of society manages to catch up. So they're always supposed to be able to visualize the thing that nobody else can visualize. And in a way, they're sort of the leaders of the zeitgeist.
Mm.
And I really see that when he was talking about birth of a new age in sort of 1913, 1914, he was onto something. I love this guy.
Completely. And the people he hung out with were those kinds of people as well. You know, it's often, I think artists do see themselves as the zeitgeisty kind of characters. You know, great artists tend to be those people.
And they're always, in a way, breaking. So that's that expression avant-garde, isn't it? If you break the new ground, the rest will follow with you. But because art is non-verbal and because it's kind of the imagined possibilities, it goes outside of the norm. You can get outside of the constrictions of the now and move your mind and your imagination forward and kind of bring everyone with you.
Yeah, you hope.
You hope.
You hope. That's the aim.
That is the aim of what art could potentially reach. And he says, you know, it's only the really great artists that will achieve this. And he doesn't even necessarily think that he's done it in his own lifetime. He lives to 77. I mean, he has a good innings, doesn't he?
It's not bad, is it, for someone
of
that time?
It's not bad, is it?
Who's moved around as much as he had.
True.
You know, because I think that must play an influence on his work as well a little bit.
Do you
think?
The
way he jumped around. Yeah, I would have thought so, because he kept jumping from one place to another based on the fact that he was essentially being kicked out of
the place. Exactly. Everyone was like, you know, you were really interesting, but we just can't cope with you. You're just too much. So he starts out in Moscow, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. And then there's a sort of Greek element somewhere in there, I think.
There's always a Greek element in this.
Yeah, Mark's married to a Greek, so we can joke about this.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You've got the Moscow period, then he goes to Germany, Bauhaus, hugely important. Yeah. He becomes one of the chief tutors of design at the Bauhaus. Yeah. That's huge.
Yeah, and his work really changed during that period, didn't it? This is kind of where this style really starts to form itself, because the bits before where you see him really playing with colour.
Yeah.
But the forms are kind of a little bit... They're not abstract. In fact, they are recognisable as forms of something natural, and so I think that's maybe one of the definitions that make it not abstract.
I think you're right. So like Blue Rider that he's famous for.
Yeah.
That to me is just a complete expression of him starting to tap into colour theory and
in his little gang.
Him and his little gang, the Blue Riders.
Yeah, the Blue Riders.
They're so cool.
I wanted to be in a gang called the Blue Riders.
He could have started one. Yeah. We still can.
Never late.
The Blue Riders. But yeah, so he had the Blue Riders, but that was all this idea about kind of moving forward with colour.
Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. As soon as he got to Bauhaus, it was that idea of form, because of course everything that Bauhaus was trying to do, it was quite constructivist, it was trying to be functional, clean, practical, taking the human element out in a sort of way, and suggesting that actually there are forms and styles that can appeal to everybody, regardless of individual intervention. But actually, in his time at the Bauhaus, he becomes really frustrated with that, and he starts to reject it. This painting is one of the paintings that's part of that rejection. Because I think what he really believed in was, no, there is something that is unique and valuable, and individuals can express these things in completely unique ways. Totally. And you mentioned that relationship with Schoenberg, but music, I think, was the freedom for him, wasn't it?
Well, he had that moment, didn't he, where he was at a concert, I think he was in Russia, just before he left to go to Munich, where he heard Wagner.
Yes.
What piece was it?
Lohengrin. That's it.
And he thinks that was his synesthesia epiphany moment.
So your Reiki and piano moment has
Wagner. Wagner does it for most people. I don't think often people get Reiki under a piano, but so at that moment in his life, he saw a lot of colours coming through Wagner's music. Mm. And I think later on in his life, he obviously develops that relationship with Schoenberg, which, you know, Schoenberg, although Wagner towards the end of his career was experimenting a lot more with that atonal palette. Mm. But Schoenberg obviously ran with it.
Seriously,
completely.
Yeah.
And the moment that he started to sort of experience colour in music really was a sort of release of the shackles a little bit. Mm-hmm. with his paintings.
And he
tapped it straight into his work at that precise moment.
I mean, Kandinsky is one of those incredible artists, a bit like Picasso, where if you look at the early work, you could hardly recognise their hand. You know, the early stuff he did, he was trying out pointillism. Mm. He loves Monet. In fact, one of the things that really impresses me about Kandinsky's career is how radically he changes his style.
Mm.
So you can see him toying around, trying to find familiarity with both Russian artists, which a lot of the time he was rejecting some of the communist art that was coming out in particular. He didn't want hyperrealism. He was drawn more to the Impressionists. And then when he was about 30, he gave up being a lawyer, and he actually went to see an exhibition by Monet. And he writes this gorgeous thing about when he saw Monet's haystacks. He says that it was a haystack in the collection. I could not recognise it. This non-recognition was painful to me. So the idea that he's being told the subject matter, he's just like, well, I don't see that. Mm. I consider that the painter had no right to paint indistinctly. How dare he paint indistinctly? I duly felt that the object of the painting was missing, and I noticed with surprise and confusion that the picture not only gripped me, but impressed itself erratically on my memory. Painting took on a fairy tale power and splendour.
You can see where you can see that happen.
That is abstraction quote to me. It's like you're telling me it's a haystack, but because you've done it in this impressionist style, I can't see that. But instead, what I'm seeing is an absence of narrative. Mm. And actually, in that absence of narrative, I feel fantastic.
if you cut the haystack out of that picture and said, "What is this?" to somebody, they wouldn't say it was a haystack.
No. And again, I think what was really fascinating him, and he liked fauvism as well, like the fauves, as I say, just some pointless stuff in the manner of Sura. And I think it was that already, it was that exploration of colour was really gripping him.
Yeah, yeah.
But he still was painting recognisable scenes, landscapes.
Yeah, he liked his churches and graveyards.
He liked his graveyards, churches, horses. And then he goes through this abstract sort of revelation, if you like. But you think it's definitely down to the music. It's down to the Wagner, and then he ran with it.
Well, it's difficult to say if it was definitely down to it, but the way he reacts to it himself in letters to Schoenberg, it does come across as though this was his moment where it kind of everything clicked for him a little bit. Mm. And when you look at the picture and you read that quote shall I read the quote out?
Yeah, go on, because you've done your own work as well.
When you look at the picture and you hear what he said to Schoenberg, you can completely see it in this picture, can't you?
Go on.
So he said to Schoenberg, "In your works, you have realized what I long for in music, the independent progress of individual voices to their own destinies. That is exactly what I try to find in my paintings."
That's awesome. And that's exactly what I was trying to say, I suppose, about him rejecting constructivism and that idea of a norm for people. It's an individual voice. And he thinks music is the purest expression of the individual psyche, doesn't he? I mean, that's something he writes a lot about.
And the idea of collecting ideas and putting them on a canvas and then each having their own validity in that canvas. And they're very different things that are going on.
They are.
And when you look at it, there are very different things going on. I mean, it's clearly a Kandinsky because we're used to seeing it. But when you look at some of the forms on it, you can that quote has a lot of power.
There's even a suggestion of notation throughout this, because you've got staves.
It's almost staves that he
does. They're almost musical symbols, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing you could imagine. Again, because I'm more visual than musical. I love music and I understand musical theory. But to me, I would know. I mean, that's almost like a glissando, isn't it? That squiggle.
Yeah.
And that to me absolutely could be sound. I could see sound with that.
There have been some modernist composers that have experimented.
They have, yeah.
Writing music to present to players that defies all the rules of what we're used to seeing on a printed page of music. That kind of follow some of these ideas that are meant to grab your imagination and take you on a little bit of a journey. And that I find this painting takes you on this really odd journey between something I kind of understand on one side of it, and then is this the chaotic mind bit trying to process everything that's going on the left-hand side? I mean,
I think if we read it in this sort of the Western tradition of left to right, then you can see it starting off with these quite fine dark lines. And I mentioned earlier about the contrast between white and black.
Mm.
White is supposed to be complete clarity, whereas black is complete conclusion. So you could see black as the end. So in a way, the more white on the left and heavier black on the other side means it's moving towards that blackness, that conclusion.
But he's happy he's got there.
Yeah, and it's
what's
that
in the top
big,
corner. Yeah. You know, it's the yellows.
But also there's that big stop, that big full stop, the black full stop at the bottom that always catches my eye. But there is this sense in which it's building up, it's a crescendo. The black lines are getting heavier as they move across the canvas. But also the colour changes, there's the hints of the reds and the blues on the left. And then those reds and blues really get picked up with, and they move up towards the right-hand corner, because he's an absolute king of composition. He can divide a canvas along planes.
Mm.
And I think you can see this very much as having, you know, a quartered planing where the action is creeping up into the top right-hand corner. And that's where the chaos is happening, but it's also where the beauty is happening. You've got circles spilling out. You've got triangles and rectangles all overlapping each other. And he talks about points and lines. He talks about moving. The point is the finest expression of a moment, and the line is the sort of extension of that moment. So there's a lot going on here about movement and progression. And I absolutely think it looks musical to me. But as a non-musician, I wouldn't know what the hell to do with this.
I love the use of the word crescendo for this, because I totally agree. Because the purple, for me, that sort of frames the
left. Oh, that's your lovely happy colour.
It's the mysterious colour.
Mysterious.
You know, I think there's this, it's almost like the orchestra's warming up to the left and the bottom.
Oh my gosh.
And then as the orchestra's rising, as it goes through this sort of process of grids and overlapping shapes and very contrasting colours, to this top corner of yellow, which is almost like the fanfare on the trumpets. Oh, it's like, ta-da, we're here. It's like, I've had my idea and I've processed it. And I've got to the end of it.
Oh, that is gorgeous. I love that. I love that. And actually the diagonal, the big, thick, black diagonal.
It's pointing there. Everything's forcing you up.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But and then knowing how you feel about the colour purple, which is different to me. I mean, I'm ambiguous towards purple. Yeah, yeah. I have no feelings towards purple.
It's not a colour I use a lot, because it's a kind of murky colour.
It is.
In composition. It can be misinterpreted, which I think is why I don't
you avoid
often
it.
Play around with it. But whereas yellows, oranges,
much clearer,
blues, you know, that people have, you can write something that people will latch onto. That color green is another color.
One of the ones he's really clear about, isn't it? Because green is sort of
doesn't cross over.
That's just what it is. Green is green. So the primary color of yellow, which is calm and serene and personal, against the slightly alienating celestial blue, combined to make green, which is just in a way a non-entity, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like a plateau.
Yeah.
And he does that with a lot of his colors. So actually, red and blue making purple. He again talks about being one of these plateaus, these sort of meeting colours. But you can see the fact he's used those little checkerboards, those little grids. It's like he's constantly exploring the range of colours. And that's what he lectured on. You know, he was a lecturer for years on colour.
Did he have any order in those checkerboards? Did he ever talk about whether or not there were some codes in
codes
there?
You know? I don't know. That's well beyond my experience.
Okay. All
right. But I would love the idea that that's some sort of do-do-do-do-do moment in art.
And it's such a recurring theme.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, I think one of the things where him and Schoenberg may have sort of fell out a little bit, because Schoenberg just couldn't stand repetition. His goal was to have everything evolving independently and being a little bit chaotic. Well, not chaotic really, but
unrestrained.
Yeah,
those grids are incredibly restrained. And actually, I think you start to see that happening as his work progresses, as he goes on. This is incredibly formal in terms of you just see shapes, actually. And when he goes on into his later period, the shapes are all still there. He's still playing with line and form.
Yeah.
But it becomes much more chaotic. And actually, he starts to go back to things like Russian folk art, the inspiration of mythology, and there's so much more going on. He starts to introduce new figures, new shapes. Whereas this really, we could see him at his zenith of exploring these ideas of colour, texture and sound, actually, which is why it is so exciting to talk to you about it. We have gone on for a very long time. We've had a lovely chat. Mark, I when I found out you had synesthesia, I could not wait to get to talk to you about Kandinsky. And you've been amazing. There's so much more I want to ask you. I want to step inside your mind and see how you work when you compose, because I'm sure it's an absolutely fascinating
Can you make tea?
Fine.
That's rule one of any work experience person is making tea.
It's absolutely extraordinary. I'm really excited about the projects you've got coming up.
They're very exciting. And the Danger Tree, you know, it goes up a whole nother gear up until sort of middle of next year. So I'll keep you informed with that.
And I will keep the Art Detective listeners going informed as well. I've seen a sneak preview of it, and it, as I say, it was one of the most extraordinary moving experiences. Thank you for joining me
on the Art Detective. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Dr. Yanina Ramirez. Are you on Twitter, Mark?
I am.
You are. I found you recently. You're quite new to it, aren't you? You're a baby on it. But,
no, I'm one of those quiet Twitterers.
A lurker.
Yeah, I'm a lurker.
Go give your Twitter feed, now they'll find you.
I think it's Mark _ Cannon.
There you go, that's quite straightforward.
We can post that. Yeah, follow me.
Follow him too.
Make you feel love.
Keep up with his projects. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, you can subscribe at historyhit.com/artdetective. It just remains for me to say thank you.
The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.